Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte, episode 28 for October 19th, 2011. Jeff Jarvis. Triangulation is brought to you by Ford, featuring Wi-Fi connectivity with available sync and MyFord Touch. Now your car could be a Wi-Fi hotspot. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus at Ford.com/technology. It's time for, hello, how are you? Good to see you. It's time for Triangulation, the show that really gives Tom Merritt and I a chance, and me, a chance to talk to the biggest minds, the smartest people, the most interesting people in the business. That's really why we created the show.
My favorite part of the day.
Yeah, we just want to talk to cool people.
Yeah.
And I can't think of anybody cooler to talk to than this fellow right here.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
So Jeff Jarvis, everybody knows. Hello, Jeff.
Hello there. I'm so honored to be on Triangulation. I cannot tell you.
Oh.
I'm honored to be on Twig. I'm honored to be on Twit. And now Triangulation. Everybody's going to be so sick of me.
You know what's funny is I'm such a fan of Jeff's, and Jeff has always been so kind. And I just was, you know, when we started doing this week in Google, I thought, well, I would love to get Jeff Jarvis, but we'll never get him. I mean, he's way too good for us. And I was so honored and thrilled that you and then Gina Trapani, both agreed to do that show. And it's made that show what it is, which is a remarkable success.
Leo, I'm not blowing smoke up your rear when I say it really is the favorite part of the week for me. And the response from the audience of the Twit Network is incredible. Not just because, you know, I get recognized from San Diego to Munich, but also because they're just nice people. You attract nice people and smart people, and it's really great.
We have a really great community. I think that's really,
you do.
For everybody who gets to work on Twit and be on Twit, that's universal responses. We just love the community. It's a love fest.
Well, everybody who works here and everybody who's in that chat room and everybody who watches our shows, they all care about the same things.
Yeah.
They may not agree
it's
on
a community
it,
of
but
interest.
They all care about it.
Yeah, it's a community of interest, and that's really what makes it so interesting. You know, young, old, all over the world, but we share that one thing, and that's really what binds us together. So Jeff is here because, he's here for a lot of reasons. I've wanted to just kind of sit down and talk to him. Tom and I both have for a long time, but also because you got a new book.
Yay!
So let's plug the book, Public Parts. What is it?
Hold it up there.
What does it look like? Back. See, I can hold up my copy, but yours is so much bigger. That's awesome. That's awesome. So your previous book, What Would Google Do, was not doing what Stephen Levy did, which is kind of document Google, but to talk about Google and
from a distance. It was even controversial to some, but I did not report from Google as Stephen did so well. I wanted to kind of reverse engineer Google in that case and say, here's a company that understands the net. What makes them successful and what can you do?
From the outside. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the idea behind, you know, it's funny because you started Public Parts while you were doing This Week on Google, and we kind of watched you go through this process. But so I know a little bit about this, but why did you want to write Public Parts? What was the genesis of this one?
It started out of seeing so much kind of maniacal interest about privacy. And let me make clear here that privacy is important. It needs protection. I have a private life. Even you, Leo, have a private life. You know, it matters. But I was afraid that we're going to pay so much attention to privacy, 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 that we might lose sight of the benefits of publicness. And our tool of publicness is the thing that we all here at Twit love, which is the internet and what it enables people to do. And so I wanted to explore that. As I went along, I found I had to deal with privacy more than I would have thought. They're not binary. It's not either or. They're not at war. It's kind of like hot and cold. But we do pay so much attention in new technologies to the worst that can happen. And that's where the privacy discussion is. But I also wanted to pay attention to the best that can happen.
I love that. If you're one of the few who does that. I mean, most people really do. You get, I'll tell you what, you sell a lot more books if you say how horrible things are going to be.
Yeah, but because people like to jump to conclusions. They like to think about what makes sense in a simplistic way and obsess on what they think. Oh, well, obviously if I put something online, everyone will see it and use it in a negative way. And that's actually just not true. So what I like is that you're taking it from the perspective of let's actually examine what will happen. And what will happen that's positive.
It's much more difficult.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's easy to say, oh, it's going to be horrible, than to say, well, let's look at this. Let's be measured.
Yeah. What I found was, to my surprise, is that panics and fears about privacy are tied to new technologies over the years. Mm-hmm. When Gutenberg came out with the book, the earliest authors were scared of having their names associated with their thoughts set down permanently, spread widely. Jonathan Swift has this great line about how a book of verses kept in a drawer and shown to a few is like a virgin much sought after, but once published is a common whore anyone can buy for 2 crowns.
So true.
I've thought that many times.
About my blog.
And you can buy me for more than 2 crowns, I'll tell you that.
Well, who was it used the term moral, what did she call it? Moral terror.
Moral panic?
Moral panic.
Yeah, I think we're kind of in that in privacy. And again, it's about technology. Here we are on Twit, and we love technology, and we look for the opportunities in it. And there are others out there, some of whom I will not name, who see us as utopians and mock our passion. But I think that what we're looking at is the possibilities. And call me a utopian, and I'll take the label, because I think we have to look at the edges of possibility. We have to look at the worst and guard against it. But if that's all we do is manage the worst case in life, we'll never get to the best. And, you know, I was out in California last week, and it is the valley of the best possibilities.
I always feel like fright is an implement of control, and optimism is an implement of freedom. And that, you know, that there are exceptions to
both
of that.
Treat that, somebody.
Huh? Yeah, it was very well said. I like that. Yeah.
I like that. Yes.
I don't know if I'm maybe I'm quoting somebody accidentally.
No. There's no.
But when you scare someone, you say do less. You know, let me limit you. And when you say actually, there's all kinds of opportunities here. Go out and try things. You're saying be free.
Exactly. And you know, one of the questions I often ask is whether the internet is innately American or whether America kind of now mimics the internet. Are we mimicking the architecture of the net? But I think there's a necessary optimism to the net. But when we disrupt life, when we disrupt industries and norms and changes, people get scared. And I think sometimes perhaps we tech people, we geeks, we utopians aren't well aware of that. One of my favorite anecdotes from researching the book is that the first serious discussion of a legal right to privacy in the U.S. came in 1890 because of the invention of the Kodak camera.
Oh, wow.
And the New York Times at the time has clips talking about how there were fiendish Kodakers lying. And Teddy Roosevelt banned Kodaking from Washington parks.
No kidding.
Because the fear that people would put their pictures up online because that was scary.
Yeah.
And you know, you go through the years after that with microphones and video cameras and the telegraph and the telephone, and all these technologies caused a certain amount of fear in people that we were changing their lives, and we indeed were. So now we hit the internet, which I think will prove to be, and I could well be wrong, and I'll be dead by the time we know, but I think the internet could prove to be every bit as disruptive as the Gutenberg press.
Absolutely. I think it's proven to be already.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody would dispute that. Certainly nobody who watches this show would dispute that. The reason she said called it moral panic was because it's always women and children. It's going to hurt the women and children. What about the women and the children? And even today, you know, it's child pornography and it's upskirt photos. The women and the children we've got to protect.
Children are like Hitler in that way.
It is.
In that way alone.
Godwin's law.
Don't tweet that. Children are like Hitler.
No, don't tweet that.
But it's true. It's like you'd bring it up. Well, I can't argue with you because I don't want to be seen as either hating children or loving Hitler.
Right, right.
Well, Tom, that's the amazing thing about I don't know if I mentioned this on Twitter or not, but COPPA, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, has a lot of unintended consequences. The idea of the act that's in force is that you shouldn't use any information about a child under 13. Two or three unintended consequences. One is that just as on the internet, no one knows you're a dog, everyone is 14. Children learn to lie about their age. the wonderful Dana Boyd has a paper coming out in a few weeks that I got to read secretly that really breaks open some new territory there. Parents don't really use the act to try to get notice and do things. But more importantly, what I realized is that because companies don't want to deal with any child under 13, the unintended consequence is there are no sites online for children under 13.
COPPA killed it.
It's too ridiculous.
Well, and now they want to extend COPPA to make you can't even have a cookie if somebody visiting your site, any site, is under 13. Which means even TWIT would have to validate the age of every single person who visited the site.
To set a cookie.
It's exactly the opposite of what its intended consequences.
The FTC pulled back on moving COPPA to 18, but now there is an effort to do a do-not-track law for up to age 18.
Crazy.
And do-not-track itself is insane.
I want to talk about this because I think if you listen to Security Now, where we talk about do not track and we talk about the dangers of tracking and Steve Gibson is anti-cookie and he runs no script and everything. That's one side of it. But there are real consequences to not allowing tracking on the internet. What are the good points? Why would we want to be allowed tracking?
Well, it supports you, Leo, right? If you cannot track your audience, you can't target the advertising. You also can't reduce the frequency, which also, by the way, is an irritant to the audience in terms of ads. You don't know how much of an audience you have. Listen, you know, I started the magazine Entertainment Weekly. I teach entrepreneurial journalism, and every year I teach that magazine. And this year I pulled out the budget, and I saw this line in there that I'd forgotten, which was list rental.
Oh,
we
yeah.
as a magazine sold your name and your address and what you read.
It's income.
And if we did that, if we said we did that online today, we'd be shot. But if you gave money to NPR years ago, there was a reason you suddenly got mailings for hemp tote bags. Right? They sold your name. They sold that you gave them money. And so we're actually, I think, in a better case today, far more anonymous than we were. But there's this demonization of the idea of tracking. Tracking does give you relevance. It gives you less irritation in really junky beat the monkey ads, and it helps support the sites that give you the content like TWIT for free.
But I think what
and
people
you have
react
every right to get rid of it, but it's going to hurt people.
I think what people react to is being tracked and not knowing it. They want the choice.
Yes.
They want to be able to say, okay, you can track me, but you can't. Maybe
you're
somebody's
right, Tom.
Yeah.
And the industry did a terrible job, I think, in terms of letting people know what it was doing, why it was doing, what the benefit was. And that's the fault of media and advertising. And they deserve some of the crap they're getting for this. However, it's just the way the business operates. And to say that you have a right not to be tracked is to say that you could get the San Francisco Chronicle every day with all the ads cut out for you.
You know, my son is 17. Your son, Jake, is what, 19?
20 now.
Yeah, 20. Wow. How fast?
Yeah.
So he started getting mail in the mail from the U.S. Marine Corps, from the Ooh. U.S. Army, saying, would you like some nice Army hats or gear or, hey, this, you know, bedspread? And
no obligation.
No obligation, of course.
Just your life.
And I'm trying to think, how do they know that my son just turned 17 and is going to be 18 in 9 months?
Here's the question. How sophisticated is Henry about that? And knowing what's happening to him.
I asked him, and he doesn't care.
Right.
He says, it's just junk mail. I don't care.
Just yeah. spam.
Just spam. Him.
You throw it away.
How did you know he was getting it?
I saw it. When I go to the mailbox, there it is. And there's quite a bit of it. And you know what I think? I'm pretty sure. When he was born, the hospital sold his information because we started getting baby stuff. And as they got older, we got age-appropriate stuff all along. And even through four moves, they continue to follow us. So this stuff has been going on forever. I remember interviewing somebody who said, oh, I could tell me your zip code. I'll tell you what magazines you subscribe to, what kind of shoes you wear, what kind of car you drive. They've been able to do this for a long time. This is
Absolutely.
Nothing new.
We're better than we used to be. I can go to Axiom, which is a database company, and I can do a search and buy the names of every woman within 2 miles. Well, I'm going to creep you out here. Within 2 miles of my house, who's 20 to 30, who has a college education, right. who earns this much money, who's single. Right. Now, that's creepy, but that's pre-internet.
Right. But and somebody saying, well, hey, your birth is a public record. I'm not saying they shouldn't have that information. I'm just saying that that information's out there. It's always been out there. People have always traded in it.
Yeah.
It's not that it's illegal or wrong. But it's not new, is I guess what I'm saying.
Right. And so the reflex is to regulate the technology.
I tell you,
reflex is to say the technology is what's wrong.
I tell you, you know, we talked about this on Twig, that the two guys who went on Facebook in the UK and incited a riot got a far worse prison sentence than all the other people who rioted. And I think it's because they did it on Facebook.
And there's just a stigma.
There's a stigma. In fact, they tried to get people to riot. Nobody did. All they did was post a status update. But because it was technology, and I see the same thing with my kid, a crime, quote, crime or a misdemeanor at school that has to do with technology is treated far more seriously than the same thing in an analog world.
And that's just fear.
It's fear.
It's false assumption. It's the reverse of the idea that if I get interviewed for television, I'm famous. You get interviewed by local television.
Right.
Now you're not famous. You walk around, nobody recognizes you.
No.
Nobody even watched that segment. It's the opposite of that. It's like just because your data is out there does not mean your privacy is like everyone knows about
you. I get recognized from Twig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know you do, too.
More than
TV. I really get recognized. Yeah.
So let's talk about public parts. Actually, let's take a break, and I want to come back and talk about public parts because you've made a decision in your life, Jeff, to live in public. And I'm really curious when that happened, why you made the decision, what the benefits are.
I want to hear about you, too, in that way, Leo.
Well, good. We'll have a conversation about it. But you've done more thinking about it than I have. I'm just a knee-jerk exhibitionist. But before
accidental exhibitionist.
it comes natural. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about those great folks at Ford. Oh, I'm so excited. I hope you're going to come to this, Tom. And maybe we can fly Jeff out. We're going to do a couple of Ford barbecues with new Ford vehicles. A chance for it'll, you'll, we'll tell you all about it. You'll have a chance to win admission to the barbecue and to see the stuff. It's going to be really fun. Ford is doing something really, I think, really interesting. They're America's original car company and all of that. But I think they see themselves heading into the 21st century as more than an automobile company. They see themselves almost as a consumer electronics company. And one of the reasons that they buy advertisements on Twit is because they realize that the best people to talk to, people like you who are interested in these technologies that they put in their new cars. Amazing technologies like the Bliss system, the Auto Park system. Now you can with Ford Sync and the Ford My Ford Touch. If you have this in your vehicle, they put it in the 2012 Ford Focus. You can plug in one of those USB 3G keys into the car, and the whole car turns into a Wi-Fi access spot. With, by the way, WPA, very strong WPA 2 networking security, and all of that. But you now everybody in the car, up to five people in the car, can use the connection because they built antennas into the car.
It's a hotspot with wheels.
It's the first rolling hotspot. It's things like this that just really are mind boggling. The technology that they put in the engines, the sync itself. When we've been talking about Siri a lot. I've been telling my car to set the temperature, to tell me what the traffic is, to tell me where the nearest gas station is. I've been doing that for 2 years since I bought the Mustang. This is not new. It's been in Ford for a long time. It really is exciting to take something like an automobile that is really a 20th century invention and take it into the 21st century. And Ford is really excited about it. When I talk to Alan Mulally, their CEO, and all the people at Ford, they're just so turned on by what they're doing with these cars. They want you to know more. If you go to Ford.com/technology, they've got a site all about this, about the engines, about the new electric cars, the new hybrid cars, little things like the capless fuel filler that's just, it's a little thing, but it makes a huge difference. The My Ford Touch, which is pretty amazing. There's the site right there, Ford.com/technology. Look at the seatbelts with airbags built in it. All sorts of really cool stuff. If you want to find out more, go there or go to your Ford dealer and take a look at what Ford is doing. We were down on the assembly line last year, and it's just, look at that. It's such a good idea. Ford.com/technology. And do find out about that Wi-Fi access point you can put in your car. The first rolling Wi-Fi
access point. Works for the BlackBerry, too, over Bluetooth.
Yeah. You don't have to have the... That's right. Yeah. You could use a BlackBerry. Not that anybody I know has a BlackBerry, but
there's a couple of them in the audience.
You know what? I'll tell you what part of the problem is that the traditionally in the automobile industry, you start designing a car 5 years ago, right? Yeah. Ford's turned that around. I think they got an 18-month design cycle now, so they're catching up. They're able to do stuff like that. But probably 5 years ago, they said, we should make this work with BlackBerry. Now, that'd be something. And little did they know.
A lot of business users still have BlackBerry.
No, they still got their BlackBerries. I love what Ford's doing, and I know you will, too. Visit a Ford dealer. I rented the Edge. You know, next time you rent a car, rent an Edge with a My Ford Touch. Whoa. Or visit Ford.com/technology. We thank them for their support of our fabulous triangulation program. So when did you make a transition, Jeff, from private to public? Was that a conscious transition? When did that happen for you?
It was definitely subconscious. I mean, when I was at the Examiner many, many, many years ago, longer than ago than I'll admit, I was a columnist of the paper, so I lived publicly then, you know, to some extent. I thought publicly, and that makes me different, I recognize. Then I was hidden for many years as an editor. And blogging after 9/11 really taught me the value of the link as a connector, and it really changed my entire career to make me realize how media are properly a conversation. And so that changed, and that came out of 9/11, but that changed how I saw things. And then after I had prostate cancer, I wrote about that and my, as we've talked about on Twig, my malfunctioning penis on your air. Aren't you grateful?
You cannot get more public.
You can't. You cannot.
Not much.
Walk me through the process there. Oh, I got prostate cancer. Got a blog. What?
Well, I also not I'm going to play like my parents say in Florida the organ recital, but I also have a heart condition, which is a regular heartbeat and AFib, and I'd written about that in the blog, and I got tremendous value. People supporting me, and you know, Fred Wilson came in and talked about his father who has it, and just amazing people who helped through that. So when I did get the diagnosis, right, my reflex was to go blog about it. Now, in fact, I couldn't because son Jake was off at Carnegie Mellon for the summer, and I wasn't going to have him learn about dad's cancer on a tweet. You know, so I had to, you know, Dr. Strangelove my arm down and wait till he got back.
That, by the way, I've had to go through that too to protect the family, and it's the hardest thing in the world. You go, I just want to talk about it.
Yeah.
I don't want to check with you.
And it is hard because you're bringing your family into your glass house, right? And it's their privacy, but it's a publicness by association. But so when I blogged about it, I got great response. There's a guy named Andrew Tyndall who analyzes cable and TV news in New York and really a brilliant guy. I didn't know he'd had the operation 10 years before. He didn't know I was going to have it. Once I blogged about it, then he knew I was. He sent me email with incredible detail about what I was going to go through. And I blogged that I was doing this because I wanted to help those who would follow in Google search. And Andrew came in and said, okay, if you're going to do it, so will I. And he took everything, he sent me an email and put it online and more. Other people came in. A wonderful woman who is a good friend of Twit, Francine Hardaway, came in and told the tragic story of her husband after she'd fallen in love with him. It turned out that he had the diagnosis and he had waited too long and she lost him to prostate cancer. She told this story. I saw her at the Pivot conference, Brian Solace's Pivot conference in New York this week. And I said, you know, all I did was reveal my body. She revealed her heart in this. And I think that she honestly saved lives in bringing people in and saying, you know, get it checked, folks. So that was really inspiration to see that there's a value to living publicly. And apart from one person who accused me of oversharing, I got no ill will out of this. Nothing bad happened to me out of this. I got only good coming to me from talking about my malfunctioning private parts.
I think you talking about that made Leo have to go to the bathroom.
it does bring up the prostate, yes.
There's a pressure suddenly. Power of suggestion.
A pitcher of iced tea. I just should always remember, before you sit down, if you drank a pitcher of iced tea,
well, you're incredibly fast, man. You've got no prostate problem.
No, I started when you started talking. I thought, oh, I probably have a few minutes here.
It's a Jarvis spiel, yeah.
Busted. Talk about living in public. All right, I feel much better now.
No, but what you're saying, I think, you know, the overshare comment sticks out to me because I think some people don't want to share this sort of thing because they're embarrassed about it or they don't want to share medical information. But others are like, you know what? The truth's the truth, but I don't want to make other people uncomfortable.
Well, yeah, and Tom, that's a good question. There's one guy, Mark Derry, who didn't like me anyway, blogged that I was oversharing. But oversharing is a very odd concept because what he's really telling me to do is shut up.
Shut up, yeah.
I don't want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah.
And the beauty of the architecture of our social net that's coming out is that he has the option to unfollow me, defriend me, not click on me. Yeah. All those options are there. So really what he was doing was over-listening.
Oh, I love it.
Right? And he was hearing too much. And if he doesn't want to listen to me, don't listen to me.
Yeah, don't read it. Over-listening. I love that idea. Wow, that's interesting. So how has it been for you? I mean, you mentioned that all these people responded. I mean, that's a huge value, especially when you're going through something difficult and you hear from people who went through the same thing.
Well, let's be clear. You know, as the doctor said when I got the diagnosis, if you're going to get cancer, this is the one to get.
Right.
And it's like cancer light. Right. I didn't go through anything that you see on 50-50, a very good movie, by the way, or anything else. No radiation, no
chemo. Break bad.
None of that. Yeah.
He's been making meth for years. Don't listen to him.
So it was easy for me, but the more important for me is I find that everything I do online, including you know, Twig and all these things, teach me lessons about the future of media.
Yes.
And how things
happen. So you're a petri dish. You're a test tube. You're an experiment.
I'm a big bowl of germs just floating around. Yeah.
That's kind of, you know, that's kind of how I've started to look at it, is that we are forerunners in this new area. And it's, those of us who can do it safely without much to risk, should try it. You
Which
know?
Is a good point, Leo. We, you know, it's easy for us. We're white men in America.
Nobody's,
we don't have
nobody's stalking us.
Oh, no. Leo, was there a moment for you? Yeah. Was it TV and radio that you realized you just have
a couple? Well, I mean, I probably am kind of constitutionally an exhibitionist. So it wasn't a difficult thing to do. Once I started doing radio, I mean, part of the reason I wanted to do radio is because I wanted to perform, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that happened early in my career, this is maybe a little overshared, but I'm going to share it anyway, is I took something called EST, which a lot of people knew about.
Werner Erhard.
Werner really? Erhard. Erhard Semenantoning.
And he wouldn't have let books. You go to the bathroom, Leo, as you just did.
No, in fact, he would. That was a common misunderstanding. You could you could go, but he would say, hey, you're going to miss something. But the point is that in the EST training, one of the things they do is they call it the fear exercise, where you confront your fear. It turns out everybody's kind of afraid. A lot of what we do when we create masks for ourselves and personas for ourselves is protective. We create a persona that is a shell between us and the outside world. And so this was the point of this exercise in the S training was let that go and be, you know, put yourself out there. And it's a very powerful exercise, and there's a lot of tears and an upset that comes up for it. It's actually one of the most important things that happens in the S training. I was a disc jockey at the time, and the S training was 2 weekends. So we did that fear exercise at the end of the first weekend. And I went home, and I did my radio show for a week. And I found myself in terror all of a sudden doing the radio show because I had been the kind of DJ who talked like this, who had a very persona, right, that he projected. And this fear exercise kind of prompted me to, well, let me just try being myself on the air.
Wow. And so it's a real private parts moment.
It was very. Yeah. You know what? Howard probably went through something very similar.
That he presented that moment where he suddenly realized that I've got to be honest with my audience or else I'm kind of nobody.
It was the thing that made Howard Stern so good. It wasn't just that he was funny or outrageous or sexually, explicit. He was deeply honest.
So there was a this is fascinating. I've never heard this before. So there was a moment for you after EST where you kind of had the same epiphany. You know?
I did. And
wow.
And I realized that what came to me, and it took me many years, you know, the 10,000 hours thing is right. I sucked for the first 10 years on the air. But what came to me is the more there were additional epiphanies down the road. At one point somebody said, "You know, you're trying too hard to be nice. You should just be yourself." And I decided I'm going to be a jerk. I don't care. I don't care on the. I'm going to be my. I'm not going to try to ingratiate. I was ingratiating, right? Somebody I worked with on the site said, "You're smiley smile. I hate that." And so I stopped being ingratiating. Just try to be myself. And I as I did that, I realized that the people we love the most as actors, as broadcasters, as performers, are the people who are most deeply themselves. And in fact, it's that vulnerability of opening yourself up on stage that makes the really greats great. And so that I can't claim that I've done that, but that's what I've always wanted
Leo, to do. You really have. I mean, I tell people about you because people always want to know what's Leo like. And as much as I know you, you know, I say that you have perfected the nice radio voice, but you are the voice. You are as nice as you are. And I really feel, you know, that you are not multiple people, that you're you.
Yeah.
And that's what gives you the authenticity to do what you do, and that in turn brings people to you and makes you successful. And
it works for performers. So I mean, I'm not saying that this would work for every
in like
job.
Your everyday life.
In everyday life. But it works for a performer. And I think that was the insight that taught me that it's okay to be, you know, and the other thing is, and this also came from Est, the value of the power of Est is that people are honestly sharing about their own lives. And sometimes it's ugly and messy, but they're telling the truth. And what happens when you tell the truth is, oh, well, that's me too. And so that really is an insight that being public, what it does is gives other people permission to be themselves too. And
that's
very powerful.
And that ties into what you're talking about in your book, which is what we fear when we say, oh, we want privacy. We don't want people to discover those things that we're hiding.
Yeah, think we have secrets.
Yeah.
We don't.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So, and that's this notion of more than one identity, right? That Zuckerberg gets in trouble for talking about having one identity, and people say, no, we have many identities. I don't think so. If you're an Enron slime and you're a church-going guy, one of those is a lie. You know, one of those is your true self. And I think that what we fear is being recognized as hypocrites for what our real life.
But I will acknowledge, you're talking about what Moot said, 4chan guy said, which, you know, he was saying, I don't like the way Google and Facebook require real identities. I do think that there's some nuance there. I think that it is possible to be a church-going, God-fearing Christian and still do bad things. We are complex humans. But that's part of learning. That's part of being public too. Is embracing, accepting the complexity, the flaws, the good.
But
as
it doesn't
well
mean
as
you're
bad.
More than one person. It means you're a complex person.
You're complex. The true person. True people are complex. They're one person, but they're complex.
You're different people at different times in life. Different. Right. Times a day, for that matter.
Right.
You're sleepy and grumpy when you get up, and then you're
and there's risks.
And
there's risks
later.
To this. Somebody in the chat room just said, Leo is so full of himself. And, of course, that's it. But that's exactly the risk of doing this.
Publicness attracts that, yes.
Yeah, but that's fine. I mean, you know, that's the other thing you have to learn, which is I'm sure you've learned, is you get a thick hide.
Well, you honestly say, yes, I am very full of myself.
I am full of myself. I never denied
Leo,
that.
Leo, what about, if I'm going overboard, stop me here, but you know, the problem that I think all three of us have is we have families who aren't living.
That's where it gets complex.
Because
they didn't sign up. They didn't sign up for this.
Exactly. I don't want to drag them into the glass house, but there's kind of publicness by presumption next to us. How do you manage that?
Difficultly, and sometimes I blow it. I don't want to blow it again by talking about how I've blown it. But, you know, sometimes stuff about my family or pictures of my family or whatever have gone out, and they haven't been happy about it. I talked about a year ago about a problem Abby was having, and she was very unhappy that I mentioned that on the air, as she absolutely rightly so. And that was a case of me being too public. And so you really have to kind of make those decisions. I'm now not talking about me. I'm talking about somebody else. So I need to stop.
It's part of your life, but there's a wall that comes in there for their sake, and that is very hard. And I found that too. My wife had the same conversation with me only a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, it's probably why I'll be single soon, and my family will have deserted me. They didn't choose this, and it is, you know, it's interesting. This is a problem that every person in the public eye has to. Deal with, because especially if you're a movie star or a TV personality, not me, but a big shot.
But you're different.
It's a risky thing.
You're on the air every darn day as you. Right? Obviously you do.
I initially wanted to be an actor, and deeply regretted that for a long time. I didn't get to do that. And now I'm kind of glad because I get to read my own lines. I write my own lines. I don't have to read somebody else's story. That's my story, right?
Right. Well, it's what we're all talking about here is authenticity. It's a lack of alienation.
Exactly.
You're not putting an intermediary between everything. And what the family point brings up is you saying, well, you know what? Here I do have to put an intermediary in place. Yeah. I do have to remove a little bit of authenticity, unless that person's okay with it. My wife works here. I mean, she's fine with
Eileen's
it.
Eileen's as public as you are.
My sister, my brother, there's things about them.
I don't even know that. Who's your wife?
Eileen.
I never knew that.
You've not been doing a good job of...
You're so private. You're so precious. I never knew that.
No, actually, that's been our secret the whole time. We met at Tech TV and dated for years. Nobody knew because we didn't try to hide it.
Yeah, right.
Right.
That's
right.
How you find out is what people are...
Oh, yeah. Well, good choice at Mazel Tov.
Thank you.
Very good choice. Yeah. No, it is very difficult. And maybe that's why you wrote the book, is to kind of encourage everybody. If everybody... Is Mark Zuckerberg right? Everybody just really wants to share themselves, their true self. And if everybody just did this, then we'd all get over it?
To some extent. I think, obviously, you know, we do have privacy. We have what's in our head, and no one should force that out of our heads. And if we're smart about our lives, no one can. But 800 million people can't be wrong or drunk. We're doing this for a good reason.
Mm.
And Zuckerberg believes, and I buy him on this, and some don't like this, but I definitely buy them on this, that he's not changing human nature. He's enabling human nature, that we want to share. We are social. We had, as he said it to me, privacy through obscurity, which is to say we had no choice about it. We were private because Sam Lessin, who's now at Facebook, had this great line that I quoted in the book that privacy used to be cheap and publicity expensive, and now it's the opposite.
Oh, wow.
Publicity is cheap. We can all be famous, but privacy takes effort.
Right.
Well, and don't you think that's a new situation, relatively speaking, too? I mean, it used to be everything you did was public in a smaller world.
Right. You lived in a tribal environment or a small town?
Yeah.
Believe me, if you've ever lived in a small town, which you have, everybody knows your business.
Everybody
no
knows
secrets.
Who you are and what you do and where you go. It's only recently that we've had large enough metropolises.
Anonymity is a new idea.
And anonymity by obscurity became possible.
Yeah.
That's a really good point.
In England, I'm going to get the century wrong, so I'll avoid it. In earlier times in England.
Merry old England.
It was the invention of the hall. And these were technologies. The invention of the hallway and the back stairs led to a greater sense of privacy. Right?
Right.
Before that, you had to walk through everybody's business. And
that's because we had servants and we didn't want them to know what was going on.
Precisely. Once they had the back stairs, the servants were over there, you were over here, and suddenly you have a private life that you'd never had before.
Wow.
And that explains a lot of older apartments.
Yes.
I think this is very interesting. I often like to think about, well, what was it like in pre-civilization societies? Because that's ultimately where our genes come from. That's who we are. We evolved for those pre-civilization societies. We haven't evolved for technology. I think that's, in that case, you could make the strong case that there's no such thing as privacy.
Yeah.
That's not what we want. We crave the support. And that's what I was, you know, when I was talking about my family situation, I was craving the support of this community. And that's a natural urge.
Yeah, because
it really is.
You don't want strangers to see what you're doing. You want your community to see. And I think that's the root of the fear of losing your privacy, is not that Jeff or Leah will find out what I'm doing, but
that's
those people I don't know out there.
Right.
They're the other.
Tom, that's the beauty of the chat room that I see flowing by on the screen right now, right? Those are all strangers who aren't strangers.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And that's the incredible thing about this world is that publicness disarms this notion of strangers. It disarms stigmas. It disarms this fear of perfection. What the hell? We are who we are. Life's a beta. And that's where we are. And all this that we've talked about so far is on the kind of personal level. And then there's a company level where companies be a lot smarter to operate publicly. And then there's a government level where government is too much secret by default when they should be transparent by default. And it was thanks to Twit and Leo that I ended up accidentally going to the EG8 in Paris, where we saw, I think, the threat to our greatest tool of publicness, this wonderful internet that we have. And that's what I come around to in the end of wanting to protect, is that it's a choice we all have. But if it's taken away, if regulation and government and companies take away this power of the publicness that we have from the internet, then we don't have the choice anymore. We don't have that power anymore. And that's what I fear most.
You did such a great job at the EG8 summit representing all of us. I was so grateful. And there was a certain irony in the fact that President Sarkozy, who really represents the forces of evil in this, who wants to really control the internet, teamed up with Mark Zuckerberg, who is obviously the complete opposite in this case, to deliver that pronouncement to the G8 summit. I wonder if Mark has a subversive goal in cozying up to Sarkozy.
Well, I think Sarkozy probably wanted to use Mark.
Well, I know Mark. I know that. Yeah. I know that. Yeah. But why did Mark let him? He's a smart kid.
He's gone to Davos, and Davos is you know, I'm lucky I go there, but it's you know, there's a sellout to the extent that you're going there and rubbing elbows with those folks. Mark's not going. He didn't go last year. I don't think he's going this year. But you know what the heck? When the president of France calls and says, "Will you come and talk to all the leaders of the most powerful countries in the world?" I guess he use it.
Yeah. I was going to go. Yeah. Jeff, thank you so much. I can't believe we're out of time.
I can't believe it. Once again, Leo, I want to say that the problem here is it's difficult because everybody loves you. But I got to say, man, you're every time at any event I go to, somebody comes up and says, "I watch you on Twig. God, Twig's great." And the next thing we do is say a wonderful, "Sorry, Tom, you're not on Twig." Leo and Gina are, and it's really amazing that you are a model for living not just a public life, but a generous life where people like you because you're you and you have an authenticity, as Tom said. And I think that you really are a model for how to live this public life. And it's not frightening. It requires some care, it requires some effort, but I think you get great benefit out of this, God, and I learn a great deal from you from that, and I'm grateful for that.
As always, you're way too kind, Jeff, but it's the feeling's mutual. I found a great friend in Jeff, and I'm even though I don't think we've ever had that drink that we keep wanting to have someday. But
no, but you've plied me with plenty of liquor at South by Southwest, and I'm grateful for it.
One of these days.
More beef, yeah. More red wine.
It's always a pleasure talking to you, Jeff. And as usual, there's so much more to talk about. We never have time to talk about everything.
No, I'd want to sit here and talk to you. I was excited to do this because the chance to just get and talk to you for 40 minutes straight. Every time I guest host on Twig, I just have a blast.
Yeah.
Same back, Bob.
Yeah,
I love to do that.
Yeah, that was.
Hug.
Hey. Jeff Jarvis's new book, you got to read it, Public Parts. I mean, he makes a much, we jumped around a lot, but it's a very clear, coherent case for the value of publicness. And just calm down. Calm down. It's not, it's new, it's scary, but you know what? It's going to be okay. It's available now and on Kindle and everywhere else. And Jeff reads it on Audible, which is, by the way, I hear, I haven't listened to it yet, but a very good way to listen to it.
You know, people are very nice. Twit people are very nice. I couldn't listen to me for 9 hours, but they're very nice and get it. And you can imagine the speed at which I talk, how hard it was for the poor publisher and the poor producer to slow me down and ask me a million different ways to try to take that again a little slower.
Yeah. I think we should just do a Jeff Jarvis show and just have Jeff on. And
expand. That scares even me.
Jeff, great to talk to you. We'll see you next time.
Great to talk to you guys.
Wednesdays for This Week in Google, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. I guess we'll see you Wednesday.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Take care. Well, that was fun.
That was great.
That was
Thanks, over gentlemen. Too quick, but that always is. Coming up this week in radio technology, we do triangulation every Wednesday whenever we can get a guest of the quality of Jeff Jarvis, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. That would be 2300 UTC at twit.tv. But you know what? There's lots of shows that you might have missed. You're definitely going to want to download. Always big thinkers, big ideas. This is a chewy show. You really want to sink your teeth into it. So get it at twit.tv. And we'll see you next week for Triangulation. Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Jeff.